had to go off to the Mountains of Light and spend a couple of decades training with me, I'm afraid that's about the best explanation I can give you. Merlin reached out and patted the lieutenant on the shoulder. I'm really not trying to be mysterious, Franz. Although I will admit that the opportunity to show off a bit for people who are cleared to know about my little peculiarities is one of my small pleasures.
Which is probably why there aren't more of us cleared to know about you, Austin told him sourly. The way we keep dropping dead from heart failure holds the numbers down, Merlin laughed.
Oh, it's not quite that bad. Besides, you're all fit and young. I'm sure that if anyone's hearts can take it, yours can.
That's reassuring, sir. Austin gave his superior officer a very old-fashioned look for a moment, then grimaced. I'm sure it was entertaining to scare me out of a year's growth, but the Emperor's been poking his head out of his tent every 10 minutes on the minute. I think he expected you back some time ago.
I know, Merlin shrugged. It took longer to find His Majesty's correspondent than I'd expected. And to be honest, not even a Sajin can run around too energetically without someone's noticing him.
That really is reassuring, Austin said with a smile. In the meantime, though...
He made shooing motions towards the Emperor's command tent, and Merlin nodded. Then the Sajin squared his shoulders, crossed to the tent, and rapped his knuckles smartly against the small bell hanging outside the closed tent flaps. Your Majesty, I'm back, he announced, over the bell's shimmering musical note.
Oh, you are you? The Emperor sounded undeniably testy.
A moment later, he poked his head back out and gave his personal armsman an equally undeniably sour look.
I thought you said something about dawn, he said, and glanced rather pointedly at the late morning sun.
I did, Your Majesty, Merlin admitted. There were a few complications, however.
I don't like that word, complications, Caleb said even more testily. I suppose you'd better come in here and tell me about them, though.
Of course, Your Majesty, Merlin murmured, and followed the Emperor into the tent.
Austin and Faircaster looked at one another.
Don't worry, sir, the sergeant said with a broad grin. The Emperor's very fond of the Sajin, really.
Caleb let the tent flaps settle back into place, then turned to Merlin, crossed his arms across his chest, and raised both eyebrows.
Don't you think, he said, that it might be a good idea to keep me at least generally informed about these little expeditions of yours?
There was a note of genuine anger in his voice, Merlin observed, and he had a right to feel it.
Caleb, I'm sorry. The man who had been Nimmu Alban said soberly. If there'd been time, I certainly would have told you. Unfortunately, there wasn't. In fact, I damn nearly didn't get there in time after all.
Caleb's anger visibly disappeared as Merlin's serious tone registered.
Get where? He asked.
Merlin gazed at him for a moment, wondering how Caleb was going to react. He'd kept watch on the encampment through one of his snarks the entire time he'd been gone, and he'd been relieved when Caleb automatically covered for his absence. He'd expected the Emperor to do just that, but if he'd been a flesh-and-blood human, he would have held his breath when Austin went to tell Caleb about his own absence. Fortunately, Dakin, who also knew the cover story about Sajin Merlin's visions, had made sure the Emperor was fully awake before allowing Austin in to explain why he'd awakened him in the first place, and the lieutenant had obviously half expected to be told that Caleb knew where Merlin was. Still,
sit down, Caleb, he said, waving at one of the folding camp chairs by the map table.
Just what are you busy preparing me for, Merlin?
Caleb's eyes narrowed, but he sat in the indicated chair.
I'm about to tell you that, but But before I do, you need to do two things. First, you need to understand that I did get there in time. And second, you need to get ready to do the best job of acting you've ever done in your entire life.
Merlin, you're starting to really scare me, Caleb said frankly.
That's not my intention, but I know you, Caleb. When I tell you where I've been and why, you're not going to take it excessively calmly, shall we say? And it's not going to be easy for you to pretend I haven't told you, but you're going to have to.
Will you please stop trying to reassure me? Caleb grimaced. If you have to, you can sit on me after you've told me to keep me from running around the camp like a lizard with its head cut off. But if you don't get busy and tell me where the hell you've been, you're going to see a really good imitation of a volcano.
Merlin smiled briefly, then squared his shoulders.
All right, Caleb, I'll tell you. Last night, I was going through the routine take from the Snarks in Chorus with Owl. I didn't really expect to find anything too surprising, but I was wrong. In fact...
Merlin didn't quite need to sit on Caleb. It was a close thing, though.
My God! The Emperor's face was ashen. My God! You're sure she's all right, Merlin?
Positive, Merlin said reassuringly. I kept an eye on her all the way back to Coruscant, and Sea Hamper's no slouch. He personally sat on her while he sent one of the nuns down to the bay, and Captain Hywitt took two full companies of Marines back up to the convent, under his personal command to fetch her. She's well on her way back to Dancer by now, and Hywitt and Sea Hamper are watching her like great dragons with a single cub.
Thank God, Caleb murmured fervently, closing his eyes.
Then he straightened, stood up, and put his hands on Merlin's shoulders.
And thank you, Merlin Athrawis, he said softly, looking into Merlin's dark blue eyes. I already owed you far more than I could ever hope to repay.
Now, he shook his head, would you mind very much if we named our first son Merlin? Or, he grinned suddenly, our first daughter Nimue?
Either name would probably raise a few eyebrows, but I'd be honored.
Good. Caleb gave him a little shake, then stood back and drew a deep breath. I can see why you said I'm going to have to be a good actor. How is anyone supposed to act like nothing happened when a pack of madmen tried to murder his wife less than 5 hours ago?
I don't know, Merlin replied honestly, but somehow you're going to have to. On the other hand, it could be that you've built a little bit of cover for yourself already. That business about sending me off to deliver a message was a good recovery.
Saw that, did you?
Caleb grinned crookedly at him, his face beginning to lose a little more of its ashen hue.
I figured you'd have one of those snarks of yours keeping an eye on me wherever you were.
Of course I did, and since you didn't tell anyone what sort of message it was, you can go right on not telling them. Let all of them assume you've got more irons in the fire than they know about. And since you're not going to tell them what the message was, or who it was to, most of them will put their own creative construction, shall we say, on whatever mood you appear to be in.
That'll work for everyone but Narman, Caleb said a bit sourly.
Merlin raised an eyebrow, and Caleb chuckled.
Don't misunderstand me. If anyone had ever told me I was actually going to find out that I liked the man, I would have told him he was a lunatic. As it happens, though, I do like him. And the fact that everything you've seen indicates he's genuinely decided his best hope is to be loyal to me and Charlian only helps. But that man is fiendishly clever.
I believe I mentioned something to that effect quite some time ago, Merlin observed mildly.
Indeed you did,
But my point at this particular moment is that I'm quite certain he's already deduced that Sage and Merlin's abilities are even more peculiar than all of the wild stories about him would suggest.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised if you're right about that, Merlin shrugged. One of the problems when you're using a particularly sharp knife is keeping your fingers out from under the blade.
You're taking this suspicion of mine mighty calmly, I must say.
It's not going to help if I don't take it calmly, Merlin pointed out. And assuming the man doesn't panic if he learns a little more of the truth, then he'll be even more useful as an analyst. Not to mention the fact that we'll be able to share even more of the raw data with him.
Should I assume from that you're thinking in terms of introducing him to the story we've given Pater and the rest of the detail?
As a matter of fact, I am. In fact, I think it might not be a bad idea to ask Narman to step in here.
Right now, Caleb's eyes widened, and Merlin shrugged again.
As long as we can keep the layers of our story straight, he said with a crooked smile. Let's see. We tell Franz and the rest of the detail you sent me off with a message to some unknown agent on the other side. They pass that on to the rest of the army, if anyone's wondering where I disappeared to. And we give that same story to Cherman and the rest of your officers, which will also help explain why you wanted to see Narman. After all, who could be a better advisor where skullduggery and general all-round sneakiness is concerned? Then we tell Narman that where I really spent the morning was sitting in my tent having a vision of St. Agatha's. We tell him everything I know about the assassination attempt and who was behind it, and ask him for his reactions and what he thinks would be the best way to proceed. And we tell him the message story is our official cover, and that he should simply tell anyone gauche enough to ask that he's not at liberty to discuss just who you might be sending messages to, or why you might be doing it.
I'm beginning to get a headache keeping track of who knows which part of our current set of lies, Caleb grumbled. He thought for a moment, then nodded. I think you're right, he said. And I expect Narman will take it fairly well. He's smart enough to understand why we couldn't risk telling him about something like this until we'd had a chance to evaluate how wholeheartedly he'd decided to support the Empire.
Exactly.
All right, but in that case... Caleb met Merlin's eyes levelly. Do we tell him about Holbrook Hollow?
Caleb... We're talking about your wife's uncle, Merlin replied quietly, then shook his head in self-condemnation. We all knew he had Temple Loyalist sympathies, and I should have been keeping a closer eye on him. I had the capability, but as you pointed out to me quite a while ago, I just don't have the time to watch everything. I had to prioritize, and I made a serious mistake in his case. I think I let the fact that he obviously did love her make me overconfident. And I probably counted on Benjamin's natural suspicion more than I had a right to.
He shook his head again.
However it happened, I didn't make watching him one of my priorities, and it almost killed Charlian.
But it didn't, Caleb told him. And, as I also pointed out to you on the occasion to which you've just referred, it was inevitable that something like this was going to happen sooner or later. There's only one of you, Merlin. No matter how wondrous you seem to be, no matter how hard you drive yourself, there's only one of you.
I know, but...
Stop beating yourself over this, Caleb said sternly. It's over, and she's still alive. That's the important thing. Now, you were about to say about the Duke?
Merlin looked at him for a moment longer, then gave a slight nod of acceptance.
I don't know whether or not anyone will find his body, he said.
Divas shoveled enough dirt across him and his armsmen,
and enough of that whole area is still the next best thing to virgin forest, that even searchers looking for a grave might well miss it. But if Wave Thunder goes after Kyrie, his connections to Halbrook Hollow are almost bound to come out. And explaining away his mysterious disappearance at a time like this...
He let his voice trail off then, and Caleb snorted sourly.
"Not exactly designed to put Charlian's Chisolmian's minds at ease, is it?" the Emperor said.
"No, and especially not in the Chamber of Commons, given his close relationship with the army and with Green Mountain. But that's not really what you were thinking about anyway, was it?"
"No," Caleb admitted with a sigh.
"She's a very smart lady," Merlin pointed out sadly. "Much too smart not to figure it out eventually, whether we tell her about it or not. Especially if Benjamin goes after Kyrie. So I suppose the real question is whether there's any point in trying to protect her.
And how she's likely to react when she finds out we tried to," Caleb agreed.
"Either way, I think we definitely need to tell Narman. First, because his advice on how we handle that entire nasty part of the problem would be extremely valuable. Second, because he's as smart as Charlian is. Whether we tell him or not, he's going to figure it out, so we might as well tell him the entire truth, about that, at any rate, from the beginning, and save everyone a little bit of time."
"You're right, of course." Caleb's shoulders slumped. "I only wish you weren't. She loved him like a father, Merlin. This is going to break her heart. And to be honest, I'm a little afraid."
"Afraid she'll blame it, at least indirectly, on you?" Merlin asked gently. "That she'll see her decision to accept your proposal as the real cause for what he did? And for his death?"
"Yes," the Emperor admitted.
"I can't promise she won't, Caleb. No one could. But Charlian isn't the first person who's had someone close to her disapprove of her marriage. And she didn't survive that long on the throne of Chisholm without learning to understand the way people's minds and hearts work where politics and power are concerned. Let's face it, she brought her uncle to Karras in the first place because she was afraid she wouldn't be able to trust him back home in Chisholm. She knew that much about him before she ever married you. People can punish themselves for things that don't make any sort of rational sense at all, of course, so it's possible she'll decide her marriage did push him into the actions he took, however much her intellect knows the final decision was still his and his alone. But even if she does, I think she's more likely to blame herself for accepting your proposal than she is to blame you for extending it."
"I'd almost rather she did blame me," Caleb said very quietly, looking down at his hand as he toyed with a box of marker tokens on the edge of the map table. This time, Merlin made no reply. Silence hovered for several seconds, and then Caleb straightened once more. "All right," he said more briskly. "I think you're right about Narman, so I suppose I'd better send word that I want to see him."
"And while we're waiting," Merlin said, "you and I need to give some thought to the minor problem of figuring out how an emperor, who's also his own field commander, can disappear from his headquarters encampment for at least, 4 or 5 hours in the middle of the night, shall we say?
Not to mention how we get the aforesaid emperor and field commander out of his headquarters encampment in the first place," Caleb agreed.
He shook his head and chuckled.
"I'm really looking forward to actually seeing this recon skimmer of yours. Scared to death, mind you, but looking forward to it. But coming up with a way to get me out of here is going to be a lot harder than simply figuring out how to accomplish something as minor as, convincing Hector of Coruscant that I'm really his best friend."
17. A recon skimmer in flight above Carter's Ocean. Caleb Armok's nose was pressed firmly against the inner skin of the armorplast canopy as the recon skimmer tore through the night heavens. He was the first native Safeholdian to actually fly in well over 8 centuries, and Merlin could almost physically feel the young man's delight as the Emperor sat in the flight couch behind his. Getting the two of them out of the encampment had proved far simpler than Caleb, at least, had assumed it would. It wasn't his fault he'd overestimated the difficulties, of course. Unlike Merlin, he hadn't known about things like portable holographic projectors. Like the skimmer's smart skin, the projector, strapped to Merlin's belt, worked best under conditions of less than optimal visibility. But they'd been fortunate in the rain clouds which had moved in during the late afternoon. The rain hadn't come down very hard, but its mistiness had reduced visibility and helped the two of them blend into their background well enough that they'd been able to get a considerably earlier start, well before full darkness had fallen. There hadn't been much point in leaving any sooner than that, given the time difference. 1900 in Coruscant was only 1300 in Telesburg, but Merlin was just as happy to have the extra time in hand. It meant he didn't have to fly at high Mach numbers this time, which was good, since there weren't any handy thunderstorms to conceal his sonic boom, and he'd just as soon not fly so fast he had to worry about the skimmer's skin temperature being picked up by any orbital sensors that didn't belong to him. And he preferred to get there a little early if he could. He could always spend the time circling high above Telesburg, impossible for anyone to see from the ground below, and the earlier he could set the two of them down on Charlian's balcony, the better. Caleb had reminded Merlin rather forcibly of the Emperor's younger brother when he actually saw the skimmer. In fact, if Merlin wanted to be accurate, he'd seemed younger than Crown Prince Jean as Owl brought the vehicle into a smooth hover and deactivated the stealth features. "Oh my," the Emperor had murmured, watching through huge eyes as the skimmer abruptly snapped into visibility and settled gently into the drift of dead leaves carpeting the woodland clearing 2 miles outside his camp's perimeter. His obvious delight had caused Merlin to look at the skimmer's lean, rakish gracefulness through fresh eyes, although he could scarcely imagine how its needle-nosed sleekness and swept wings must look to someone who hadn't grown up in a high-tech universe. Caleb's reaction underscored the vast gulf between Nimmu Alban's life experience and his own in a way that Merlin's time here on Safehold really hadn't. The Emperor had watched the canopy slide back and the boarding ladder extend itself, then clambered up it just a bit gingerly under Merlin's tutelage. He'd settled into the rear flight couch, and somehow he'd managed not to jump right back up out of it as its surface moved under him, configuring itself to the contours of his body. Fortunately, Merlin had warned him what would happen, but his astonishment had been obvious anyway. Merlin had taken him patiently through the various displays. He hadn't bothered to warn Caleb not to touch anything he hadn't been specifically told he could touch. First, because Caleb was smart enough not to do anything of the sort anyway. Second, because Merlin had locked all of the flight controls to the front cockpit. He'd shown the Emperor how to reconfigure his visual displays so that he could direct the skimmer's after-optical head wherever he wanted to, and Caleb had spent the first 30 or 40 minutes of their flight delightedly swiveling the head and zooming in on the land, ocean, and islands under them. He'd also spent those same 30 or 40 minutes chattering about everything he could see from an altitude of just over 65,000 feet. But now, finally, he'd sobered.
"So this is what Langhorne and the others took away from all of us," he said softly, sitting back in his seat again at last.
"This is a part of what they took away from you," Merlin corrected gently. "Believe me, Caleb, as exciting and novel as all of this is for you, it's barely scratching the surface of what Shan Wei wanted to give back to your ancestors." "Oh, Langhorne and the mission planners were right about one thing. For the first 3 centuries or so, they had to bury any memory of the infrastructure that could have produced something like this skimmer. The stealth systems built into it, and the fact that its signature would be so tiny and hard to pick up anyway, meant they could operate at least some similar vehicles without risking anything the Gababa could have picked up without doing a detailed in-atmosphere search. And if they'd gotten close enough to do an in-atmosphere search, it wouldn't have mattered whether Safehold had possessed advanced technology or not. But you could have had this back, and everything else that goes with it, 400 or 500 years ago, without worrying about whether or not the Gababa would stumble across you. Or at least without worrying that they'd spot you because they were actively looking for you, at any rate. That's what they took away from you, and from your parents, and your grandparents, and your great-grandparents. "We could have had the stars," Caleb half-whispered. "With the exercise of a little bit of caution, yes," Merlin agreed. "In fact, from the starting point of the knowledge Shan Wei was trying to preserve in Alexandria, by now humanity would probably have developed a high enough level of technology to go looking for the Gababa instead of the other way around. Not to mention the fact that the average lifespan for someone born when Nemu Alban was alive was in excess of 300 years. Or the minor consideration that the lying bastards left us stuck with spiritual shepherds like Clinton," Caleb added harshly. "Or that," Merlin agreed. "You know, Merlin," Caleb said in a rather different voice, "up until this moment, despite St. Journeau's journal and the other documents, I haven't really been able to wrap my mind around what you mean when you talk about advanced technology. Maybe that's because I haven't really tried to. I've been too concerned, too focused on just surviving to really try to imagine what the future, or maybe I should say the past, could have been like. I guess the fact that you're alive and the incredible things I've seen you do should have given me a clue, but to be honest, I've still been thinking of you like Sage and Cody. You're not technology. Not something one of Hausman's mechanics might have designed or built if they'd only had the right collection of nuts and bolts and the right wrench. You're magic. Any ninny could tell that. But now..." He broke off, and as Merlin glanced into the small view screen beside the pilot's right knee, the pickup in the rear cockpit showed him the Emperor's shrug. "There was a writer once, back on old Earth," he said. "He died over 300 years, 300 old Earth years, that would be about 330 Safeholdian years, before we met the Gababa. But he wrote something called science fiction. His name was Clark, and he said that any sufficiently advanced technology was indistinguishable from magic." "Indistinguishable from magic," Caleb repeated softly, then nodded. "That's a good way to think of it, I suppose. And it makes me feel a little better, a little less like some sort of ignorant savage." "That's good, because there's nothing ignorant savage about you. Charlian, Narman, not even Hector. Within the scope of the world view you've been permitted by the Church, you're as smart, capable, and inventive as anyone in the history of mankind, Caleb. In fact, while I wouldn't want you to get a swelled head or anything, you and Charlian are pretty damned incredible when you come right down to it. All we have to do is break down the barriers Langhorne and Bedard built to keep you all in prison, and that intelligence, capability, and inventiveness will do the rest.
Of course, breaking down the barriers is going to take more than simply defeating the group of four, Caleb said. I know you already told me that, but now, looking at all this, I think I finally realize what you really meant. Nobody who's grown up on Safehold is going to be ready for something like this without an awful lot of advance preparation. And I see now exactly why you said you can't just hand this over. Why we have to learn to build it and accept it as something which isn't evil for ourselves.
As Michael says, one battle at a time, Merlin agreed. First, we break the temple's political and economic stranglehold. After that, we tackle the lies in the writ itself. And that, Caleb, is going to be an even tougher fight in a lot of ways. The fact that 8 million literate colonists left so many letters and journals and personal accounts, absolutely honest ones as far as they knew, of how they interacted with the archangels and about their experiences on the day of creation itself, is going to leave us with a nightmare when we try to tell everyone they're all lies. The mere fact that I have a cave stuffed with technological toys isn't going to magically make 900 years of faith disappear overnight, or make the people who share that faith feel one bit happier about the possibility of falling for Shan Wei's snares. That's why we need people like Hausman, Ryan, Rajir Maklin, and all the rest. The Safeholdian scientific revolution is going to have to come from within, not be handed over by some supernatural minion of Shan Wei. And the mindset that goes with it is going to have to infect the entire planet. I only hope we can avoid an entire series of religious wars between the people eager to embrace the new and the people desperate to defend the old as their only hope of salvation. I'm not going to see Safehold building these recon skimmers in my lifetime, am I? Caleb asked softly. I don't think so, Merlin confirmed equally softly. I wish you were, and I suppose it could happen. But I'm afraid of what would happen if we crammed the truth at everyone that quickly. Maybe things will change. Maybe I'm being too pessimistic. But I've got enough blood on my hands already, Caleb. I don't want any more than there has to be.
I think I'm finally beginning to understand why you're so lonely, too, Caleb said. You're not just the only person who remembers where we all really came from. You're the one person who's going to see people like me and Father and Charlian die and leave you to go on, fighting the same fight without them.
Yes.
Caleb could hardly hear the single word, and Merlin closed his eyes briefly. Yes, he repeated more loudly.
And if you want to look at it one way, I think I've got a very good chance of being personally responsible for more bloodshed than any other single person in history.
Dragon shit! Caleb snapped the two words so sharply that Merlin twitched upright in his flight couch. Don't go borrowing gelt, Merlin, the Emperor continued in an only marginally less sharp tone. Langhorne and Bedard and Schuler are the ones who built this mess. And Clinton and Magware and Trenaire are the ones who were willing to murder an entire kingdom to prop it up. Do you think that somehow all of that would magically stop if you'd simply decided to leave well enough alone? You're not that stupid. But, and don't give me any buts either, the Emperor of Karis growled. It's a mess. Thousands of people are going to be killed, maybe millions of them. And you, and I, and my children, and my grandchildren, if that's what it takes, are going to be right in the middle of it. But in the end, Merlin Athrawes, or Nimmu Alban, the truth is going to win. And part of that truth is the fact that a batch of self-serving, corrupt tyrants chose to use God himself as a prison for all the rest of us.
I remember something I read in that history of the Terran Federation Saint Jeannot left. Something about watering the Tree of Liberty with the blood of patriots. Personally, I'd just as soon water it with the blood of a few tyrants. But that doesn't change the truth that sometimes people have to die for the things they believe in, for the freedom they want for themselves and their children. And it doesn't make you responsible for it either. Blame the people who built the prison, the ones who've spent so long trying to strangle the tree. Don't blame the person trying to tear that prison down.
Silence hovered in the recon skimmer's cockpit for several seconds, and then Merlin Athrawis smiled crookedly.
I'll try, Your Majesty, he said. I'll try.
18. Empress Charlian's Suite, Royal Palace, City of Telesburg, Kingdom of Karras. The Empress of Karras sat curled up in the comfortable armchair in her luxurious suite in Telesburg Palace, with her feet tucked under her. It was the way she'd sat when she was worried ever since she'd been a little girl, despite the best efforts of her mother, Baron Greenmountain, her uncle, and Sarai Hallman, to break her of the habit. She'd never been quite certain why a queen wasn't supposed to sit that way, at least in private, and her various relatives and loyal retainers had discovered that her stubbornness extended to more than simply matters of state. She smiled almost wistfully at the thought. It was comforting to think of such ordinary, everyday arguments and decisions, rather than the monumental upheavals of the last 2 days. As frightening as the world she faced had sometimes been before, at least she'd always been reasonably confident she understood it. Now, it was as if a doorway she hadn't even known existed had been opened, revealing the existence of an entirely new layer of reality, one that threatened to stand every comfortable known fact on its head. She'd begun to feel at home here in Karras, only to find herself once again in a new and unknown land, and this time she had no map, no shelter, and no guide to explain its frightening mysteries to her. The thought sent a stab of loneliness through her, and she looked around her suite. It was larger and airier than the one she'd enjoyed in her own palace in Chiraeth, with the pointed arches, high ceilings, thick, heat-shedding walls, and windowed doors of Carisian architecture. She'd grown accustomed to its exoticness in the months since Caleb's departure. What she hadn't grown accustomed to, and didn't want to grow accustomed to, was Caleb's absence. "You've got more to be worried about than that, you nincompoop," she told herself sternly. "You've only been married to the man for 7 months, and he's been gone for almost 6 of them. Don't you think it might be a little more sensible to spend your time worrying about whether or not Merlin is a demon after all, than how much you miss a man you've hardly had time to even start to know?" No doubt it would have been. And, in fairness, she had spent quite a bit of time worrying about that very point, despite Archbishop Michael's reassurance. Her relief when the Archbishop confirmed that he'd known the truth about Captain Athrawis all along had been the next best thing to unspeakable, although he'd declined to be more specific about that truth until after she'd spoken again with Merlin and Caleb. That had been more than a little frustrating, but she'd had to admit that it made perfectly good sense under the circumstances. And the Archbishop's serenity when he confirmed that he knew about Merlin had done more to relieve her mind than she might have believed possible, although the fact that Stainer honestly believed Merlin was neither a demon nor an angel didn't necessarily mean the Archbishop was correct. Nonetheless, she'd told herself, if Archbishop Michael was prepared to grant Merlin the benefit of the doubt, the least she could do was listen to what the Sajan had to say.
especially since, as she'd pointed out to him herself in the smoke, blood, and bodies of the failed assassination attempt, she would most certainly have been dead along with the members of her guard detail without him. Her eyes darkened, and she felt her lower lip trying to quiver once again as she thought about the men who had died to keep her alive. It had been their job, their duty, just as she had duties and responsibilities. She knew that. Yet knowing was a frail shield against the faces she would never see again, and the faces of the wives, children, fathers and mothers, sisters and brothers they'd left behind. "Stop that," she told the tears prickling at the backs of her eyes. "You can't bring them back. All you can do is to make their deaths mean something. You're an empress. Be an empress. You know who wanted to kill you, who did kill your guardsmen. Halcom may be dead thanks to Merlin, but there are scores of other Halcoms just like him out there. Now you've got another reason not to let them win." It was true, yet there were times when she felt herself being spread far too thin. When the duties and the responsibilities and the debts looming before her seemed fit to crush one of the archangels themselves, when all she wanted was to find some way to pass those duties and responsibilities to someone else, to find the time for the girlhood which had been stolen from her by a throne. Surely she was entitled to at least a little sliver of a life that was hers and hers alone, not the property of Chisholm or of Karis, hers. "And that's why you're thinking about Caleb," she thought, "because he is yours. You don't have all of him any more than he has all of you. The two of you are too many other people, have too many other responsibilities. But the writ says that to those of whom much is asked, much is also given. It hasn't seemed that way ever since Father died. Until now." Her lips stopped trying to quiver and curved in a tender smile instead. A marriage of state, yes, but so much more. Her heart seemed to lighten magically as she remembered his smile, the taste of his lips, the magic of his touch, and her own responsiveness to it. Archbishop Michael had said a true marriage was a union of shared burdens and tasks, of two hearts, two minds, and two souls, and he'd been right. There was no challenge the two of them couldn't face together, and if it was silly of her to believe that of a man she'd actually known for barely 2 months, then so be it. Knuckles rapped gently on a door frame, and she heard Sarai's voice murmuring something. A moment later, Sarai herself appeared in her bedchamber door.
"Edward is here, Your Majesty," she said.
It was a mark of how shaken Sarai had been by the assassination attempt that she didn't even frown when she saw her mistress's feet tucked up under her, like some schoolroom child's. Charlian felt an urge to chuckle at the thought, but instead she only nodded. "Ask him to come in, please."
"Of course, Your Majesty."
Sarai swept an abbreviated curtsy and withdrew. A few pulse beats later, she returned with Sergeant Seahamper.
"Edward," Charlian said quietly.
She winced slightly with the pain in her brutally bruised shoulder as she held out her hand, and the sergeant, armed and armored for duty, bent over it, kissing it, then straightened.
"I see Colonel Ropewalk decided I could have you after all," the Empress observed with a faint, bittersweet twinkle.
"Your Majesty, if you want me on your balcony all night, then that's where I'll be," he told her simply.
"I remember when you used to sit outside my bedroom door when I was a girl," she told him. "Right after Father died. I could always sleep knowing you were there, my very own armsman, to keep the nightmares outside where they belonged. Maybe I'll be able to sleep tonight, too."
"I hope so, Your Majesty."
"So do I." She glanced at her maid. "Go on to bed yourself, Sarai.
I'm not that tired, Your Majesty. If you need...
If you're not that tired, you certainly ought to be. And I'm not exactly a little girl anymore, even if I do need Edward to help keep the bad dreams at bay tonight. Go to bed. If it turns out I need you, I promise I'll ring and drag you back out of bed without a qualm. Now scoot.
Yes, Your Majesty. Sarai smiled slightly, produced another half-curtsy, and withdrew, leaving Charlian alone with Sea Hamper.
She's as much a worrier as you are, Edward, the Empress said.
Funny how you seem to have that effect on people, Your Majesty.
Undoubtedly, because people don't trust me to have the sense to come in out of the rain.
Undoubtedly, Your Majesty,
Sea Hamper agreed, and she laughed a bit sadly.
We really have been through a lot together, haven't we, Edward?
And if you'll pardon me for saying it, Your Majesty, I'm hoping we'll be through a lot more together as well.
I suppose that would beat the alternative. Still, I'd just as soon not have another couple of days as strenuous as the last two, she said,
and this time he only smiled, his eyes as sad as her own, and nodded in agreement.
Well, she said more briskly, I suppose we should get you out onto the balcony.
She climbed out of the armchair and tucked one arm into his armored elbow, walking barefoot across the bedchamber's cool marble floor beside him in a fluttering swirl of nightgown and steel thistle silk nightrobe. He opened the latticed door onto the enormous balcony and escorted her out into the cool darkness of evening. The sky was a cobalt blue dome, beginning to flicker faintly with stars, and the moon was a burnished copper coin, just peeking above the eastern horizon, but it wasn't quite completely dark yet. She could look out over the roofs of Tellisburg, across the waterfront to the twinkling lights of galleons moving out of the harbor on the wings of the falling tide. Other lights were beginning to glimmer across the capital, and she raised her head, savoring the cool kiss of the breeze on her face. Yet for all the present moment's tranquility, there was a different feel to Tellisburg tonight, she thought, one at odds with the peacefulness of the scene before her. If she'd ever doubted that her new subjects had taken her to their hearts, the wave of fury which had swept across Tellisburg on the heels of the news of the assassination attempt would have put them to rest forever.
How bad was it really, Edward? She asked now, quietly, looking at the tendrils of smoke still rising down near the river. She could see them, despite the gathering evening, because they were underlit with a faint reddish glow, pulsating gently where embers and coals still smoldered at their feet.
Not as bad as it could have been, Your Majesty.
He shrugged.
The healers are going to be busy for a while, but the city guard got there in time to keep anyone from actually getting lynched, and the firemen held the fires to just the one block around the church.
I wish it hadn't happened, she said softly, still gazing at the smoke, and Sea Hamper shrugged again.
His sympathy was manifestly limited, she realized. Then again, her armsman had always been a direct sort of fellow. But then he surprised her just a bit.
They're angry, Your Majesty, he said. Angry and, I think, ashamed. As far as we know, all of the bastards, begging your pardon, were Carizians, and they feel as if their entire kingdom's at fault.
That's so foolish, she said sadly. 3/4 of the detachment were Carizians too, and they died to stop it.
Of course they did, and eventually the rest of Carus is going to remember that too, but not yet.
Charlian nodded, knowing he was right, knowing she couldn't really have expected anything else, and grateful that, as Seahamper said, the city guard had arrived in time to prevent any fatalities, at least. She wished the guard could have gotten there in time to prevent the mob from torching the Church of Langhorne the Blessed, too,
yet that probably would have been expecting too much. She'd wondered from time to time if Caleb and Archbishop Michael had truly been wise to allow the temple loyalists who openly professed their continued allegiance to the Council of Vicars to claim one of the city's larger churches as their own. She'd been especially concerned when the people who continued to worship there began to move themselves and their families into the tenements and apartments clustered around the church, like their own little enclave in the heart of Telesburg. What had happened today only underscored her earlier concerns, but she still hadn't been able to come up with a better solution than the one Caleb had adopted. Whatever its drawbacks, she agreed with him and the Archbishop that the last thing they could afford to do would be to confirm the Inquisition's allegations about the bloody suppression of the true church in Heretic Carus by actually persecuting the Loyalists. Well, we didn't take their church away from them. Not that the Inquisition is going to admit that for a moment. She stood there, sharing a companionable silence with Seahamper, while she felt the darkness settling fully into place, then inhaled deeply.
"I suppose I should go back inside," she told him.
"Well, if you insist," another voice said. "But we just got here, you know."
She jumped, then turned with a squeak of astonishment and joy as she saw the two men standing behind her.
"Caleb!"
Later on, she could never remember actually having moved. All she remembered was his arms around her, the crushing power of his embrace, and the hot, sweet taste of his mouth. She was vaguely aware of Merlin and Seahamper standing back, watching the two of them with perfectly matched smiles, despite her armsman's own astonishment at the other men's abrupt appearance, and she couldn't have cared less. Then, finally, Caleb's arms relaxed at least enough for her to breathe, and she heard Merlin chuckle.
"I figured they'd have to come up for air soon," he said to Seahamper. "I was beginning to think I might have been wrong about that, though."
Seahamper turned a chuckle of his own into a rather unconvincing cough, and Caleb smiled.
"I hope you remembered to bring your cards," he told Merlin.
"And why might that be, Your Majesty?"
Merlin inquired politely.
"Because you and Sergeant Seahamper are going to have to spend at least an hour or so out here amusing yourselves with something."
"Ah, the impetuousness of young love," Merlin replied, and Charlian felt her cheeks heating even as she laughed. It was odd. Not even Seahamper or Sarai had ever displayed that sort of familiarity, and yet it felt perfectly natural, appropriate even, coming from Captain Athrawis.
"How did the two of you get here?" she demanded, and Caleb shook his head.
"That's part of what we're going to be telling you about, love," he said. "And trust me, you're going to find it hard to believe, but it's all true. And thank God for it. If Merlin hadn't been keeping an eye on you, hadn't been able to get there in time."
His voice trailed off, and Charlian gasped as his arms tightened almost convulsively about her once again. He realized he was crushing her and relaxed his embrace with a murmur of apology.
"Don't worry, I'm not that fragile," she assured him, reaching up to cup the side of his face in her hand.
Whiskers stirred against her palm, like a brush of wiry silk, and she smiled.
"And when did you grow all of this?" she demanded, tugging on the newly grown beard.
"I've just been a bit too busy to shave," he told her with a smile of his own.
"Of course you have."
She tugged again, hard enough to make him wince, then looked past him at Merlin.
"You did say you'd bring a character witness with you, Sajan Merlin."
"Yes, I did, Your Grace," he bowed to her. "To be honest, I don't think I could have left him home in Coruscant, even if I'd wanted to. Not that it didn't take quite a bit of ingenuity to figure out how to cover our absence. Well,
his absence, at any rate.
How did you cover for it?
At this particular moment, love, Caleb told her, the Emperor's own is guarding an empty sleeping tent. They know it's empty, even if they don't have a clue just how far away from home I am at this moment. As far as they're concerned, Sajan Merlin and I are creeping off all alone to meet a representative of a faction in Manchir, which may be prepared to turn against Hector in return for the proper guarantees of their own positions. They weren't too happy about my going off with a single guardsman, even Merlin, but they weren't prepared to argue about it. Well, not too long and hard, anyway. And they, and Narmin, understand that it's essential that no one, not even General Cherman or Bryan, know about these supposed negotiations. Lieutenant Austin and Galvin are prepared to keep anyone out of the tent until morning, but we can't guarantee that something isn't going to come up. So, much as I hate to say it, we really don't have a lot of time. And, he smiled wickedly into her eyes, we are going to spend an hour or two of the time we do have together, my lady. Which means, Merlin murmured with a smile of his own while Charlian's blush turned hotter, that we'd better get started on those explanations I promised you, Your Grace.
No wonder you've always seemed a bit unusual to me, Merlin, Charlian said, the better part of 2 hours later. She shook her head slowly, her eyes still huge with wonder, as she gazed at the guardsman who was over 900 years old. Seahamper looked almost dazed. For the first time in memory, he'd obeyed her command to sit in her presence without even token argument as Caleb began his explanation. Now it was his turn to look at Merlin, and he shook his head.
I guess I don't feel quite so old and feeble compared to you anymore, Captain, he said. I don't pretend to understand all of that. For that matter, I don't pretend to understand half of it. But at least now I know how you managed to do some of the peculiar things I've heard stories about. You really did strangle 3 krakens with your bare hands, didn't you?
Not quite, Merlin replied with a crooked smile. Then he turned back to Charlian.
Have we answered your questions, Your Grace? He asked quietly.
Oh, you've answered the ones I knew I had, she assured him. Of course, you've given me at least a couple of dozen new ones.
It does seem to work that way, love, Caleb agreed.
The thing that's going to be hardest is accepting that all my life, all I was taught about God and the archangels was a lie.
Charlian's voice was low and bitter, and Seahamper's jaw tightened, as if she spoke for him as well.
Your Grace, you really need to discuss that with Archbishop Michael, Merlin told her. You already knew men like Clinton and Trenaire could twist and abuse the faith of others. All they've really done, though, whether they knew it or not, is to follow in Langhorne's and Bedard's footsteps. The fact that corrupt and ambitious men are willing to lie even about God himself in their pursuit of power is nothing new, I'm afraid. But it doesn't make everything you've ever believed about God untrue. In fact, as much as I hate to admit it, men like the Archbishop and the Brethren of St. Journeau believed the truth when they saw it, in large part, because of the values they'd been taught by the religion Langhorne and Bedard invented to enslave every Safeholdian. Things like that tend to happen when people use the goodness of God as a weapon. My own belief is that despite the best efforts of a Langhorne or a Bedard, they aren't able to keep God from creeping through the cracks when he wants to.
Creeping through the cracks, Charlian repeated softly, then smiled.
I suppose that's one way to look at it, at least.
And I truly do understand why the Archbishop is unwilling to challenge the Church's fundamental doctrines at this point. At the same time, though, we're building up a sort of inner circle of our own, Cable pointed out. The four of us here, the Brethren, Dr. Marklin, and a handful of others in